Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Thank you for joining us today and welcome. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what and why we think as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. Emphasis on the forward slash, my lovely bride would say. So, Ravinder, say hello to the folks and let us all know what's happening in the chat room today.
Well, hi, everyone. Of course, do come join us in the chat room. I always love interacting with you and getting your feedback. It's your feedback that feeds our show. So come chat with me. It's eldontaylor.com/chat.
All right. Now, every week I read some of your letters as our way of respecting the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our show featured Lorna Byrne. Loretta wrote, I so enjoyed listening to Lorna. I am grateful you had her as a guest today. Elaine wrote, it was a fabulous show and Lorna was a great guest. Plus, it is always fun to be with everyone in the chat room. You like that, don't you, Rav?
Of course. We have an amazing group in the chat room. We really, really do.
CO wrote, I love your work and show. Listening to you and your wife is refreshing. I also find the love and respect you have for one another awesome. Now, I truly like that one. Princess, do you have any thoughts on that?
We have lots of love and respect and lots of fireworks, too, sometimes. We have a lot. We have it all, you know. We do. Thank you, honey. I love you.
Oh, thank you. I love you. Okay. Anyhow, moving along.
Wishy stuff. We need to wait.
You know, one of the questions I'm going to ask our guest today, you're going to like, because it's what's the advantage? I mean, is it rational to get married? Is it rational to have children, you know, something we've discussed
yes
somewhat
and
lately.
No, and you can decide which order those two go in.
Evgenia wrote, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, I'm a 17-year-old student from Cyprus. I have read your book, What Does That Mean? And I felt obliged to express my gratitude to you for this wonderful masterpiece. Reading your book inspired me in many ways. First of all, through your personal experiences, I saw a new perspective of life, especially in terms of religion. I reflected on how I had started viewing life in terms of science and how that left out many of life's important aspects. I believe the most important idea in your book for me was, quote, we don't really know what something is just because we can name it and describe it. And even if we did, it wouldn't remain the same simply because the world isn't a static place. The universe is dynamic and so are you, close quote. I was struggling with the decision of what I wanted to study at university for a long time and felt that I couldn't simply choose one path to follow for the rest of my life. Your book justified my thoughts that people change and so do personal interests. As you also mentioned, quote, once you name something, you begin to subtract from it, close quote. There is more to me and to the education that I want to receive than a plain title simply because it excludes so many things. I want to experiment and have the opportunity to be proven wrong, as this is one path towards self-development. I finally know where I'm heading and what I want. This wouldn't have been possible without your inspiring words. Well, you know what? I mean, the only thing I can say to that is thank you very much. Well done, Evgenia. As far as I'm concerned, Rav, that's like another warm fuzzy for the stuff we do. Charles wrote, Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you all. Every day I'm grateful for your products, of which I own several. That's a nice pithy Christmas wish. Thank you, Charles. Now, this next letter is to Ravinder. Linda wrote, Hello, Ravinder. I want to thank you for the quick turnaround of my orders. I also want to thank everyone who contributes to the work that Eldon does. I heard Eldon speak on one of Lisa Gar's recent radio shows and ended up ordering the package that was offered. When it came, I scanned the books and started listening to the CDs. There is no way I can put into words the changes that have taken place in my mind and thinking. During the short time I have been listening, I don't work outside the home, so I have lots of time to just play the CDs. There have been lots of insights come to me, one of which is that I am one of those folks who has lived in a fight or flight state most of my life, and I'm almost 65 years old. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to everyone, and thanks for listening. Well, we're absolutely thrilled for you, Linda. congratulations and Merry Christmas right back at you. You like that letter, didn't you, Rev?
It is. That's fabulous. That is what makes all the hard work worthwhile.
Terry wrote, blessings to you and your wonderful work. I wanted to express my appreciation for all I have personally attained from your CDs. Thank you so very much. You know, Rev, I do love what we do, and every one of these letters is a gift. We could spend an entire show just reading mail, but that's all the time we're going to take for it today. We have a very special guest, and I'm looking forward to this show.
Me too, so big time.
All right. That said, I do invite you to opine by sending your email to Eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show. The honest truth about dishonesty, how we lie to everyone, especially ourselves. We've talked a lot over the past years right here on Provocative Enlightenment about deception, including the many layers of self-deception that can exist due to defense mechanisms and other psychological factors. We've discussed dissonance and the impact that it has on our so-called decision process, including, of course, the unconscious decision maker, our nucleus accumbens. We've discussed mind programming and thought engineering tools and methods, and in my seminars, I always have to run two or three short trials just to demonstrate to people how predictable they really are. It's more than fascinating how the many subtle cues that go on right in front of us and go missed entirely by us influence our every decision. Now, you must enjoy this stuff because you keep coming back for more. So today, we have a real treat for you in the form of a very special guest. He is one of my favorite authors. I'd say he's my favorite author, but there are so many really great authors. But I'll tell you what, he knows better than most exactly why we lie to everyone, why we are often predictably irrational, and what we often gain by being illogical. I have three of his books, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, The Upside of Irrationality, and Predictably Irrational. We'll touch on all three some today, but our focus will be on his latest, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. That said, I mean, all three of these books are interlock your fingers. They are tongue and groove. The synopsis of which goes like this. Quote, despite our intentions, why do we so often fail to act in our own best interest? Why do we promise to skip the chocolate cake only to find ourselves drooling our way into temptation when the dessert tray rolls around? You relate to that, don't you, Rev?
I do. Okay. I really do.
Why do we overvalue things that we've worked to put together? What are the forces that influence our behavior? Close quote. New York Times bestselling author Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, is dedicated to answering these questions and others in order to help people live more sensible, if not rational, lives. Professor Ariely earned one PhD in cognitive psychology and another in business administration. His interests span a wide range of behaviors, and his sometimes unusual experiments are consistently interesting, amusing, and informative, demonstrating profound ideas that fly in the face of common wisdom. In addition to appointments at the Fuqua School of Business, the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, the Department of Economics, and the School of Medicine at Duke University, he is also a founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. And his talks on TED have been watched more than 2.8 million times. So let's get the man himself in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Professor Dan Ariely. Sir, are you there? Professor Ariely? Okay. Well, we're having a little bit of a problem here, and we may have lost our connection. We may have him back here any moment.
He's there now, I think.
Is he? Professor Ariely, are you with us? It's not a problem. We have a technical issue. Well, our producers are reconnecting Professor Ariely. Let me tell you just a little bit more about this gentleman. I have spent this past week in preparation for the radio show, checking other things besides his books. If you Google him, there are hours and hours of shows that he has done that are, they range from 2 minutes to maybe an hour and a half, where he discusses everything from the kinds of things we've talked about in the past, like placebos, to what I was suggesting in the setup call, in the setup piece, that having to do with, you know, the practicality, or shall we say the rationality, of whether or not you get married or you have children. A couple of quickies that we wouldn't take up in the show, but we will right here while we're waiting to reconnect with him. One that I sent my banker this morning is kind of a fun one. Who would you guess? In fact, I may ask him this when we do get the connection. Who would you guess is the most honest? Or let me phrase it differently. Who would you think would cheat most, your banker or your politician?
Politician, I would.
Politician, yeah. That's, I think most people, you know, would say the politician. But in a very unique study that Professor Ariely ran, what we discovered was, no, you know, it's the banker who would cheat the most.
That's actually scary.
I'm going to have him tell this story because it is a very interesting study, and it's a very interesting story. You know, in another one of the studies, a study on placebos, and we have discussed that many times on the show, how, you know, if you have a plain white pill, that has some placebo effect, typically maybe 20%, but put in a large initial on it, the placebo effect becomes greater. Make it a capsule, the placebo effect becomes even stronger. Colorize the capsule, it becomes even stronger. An injection, even stronger, and so forth. Well, in his work, as he has looked at the placebo factor, what he's discovered is not only is this very, very true, but there are secondary ramifications that aren't looked at. For example, we are valuing the influence of the placebo based on our perceived value. What does it cost, for example? One of the studies that he's conducted shows an inexpensive medicine versus an expensive medicine. The inexpensive medicine is not as powerful as the expensive medicine. Given that that's the instance, how do you think, for all intent and purposes, you would respond to a medicine if it was given to you for free, even if it were the same medicine that you had to pay a lot of money for? When the FDA approves drugs, should they require some setup of this nature where the drug is free, where there isn't a great expectation factor attached to it? This is a new miracle drug. This is just compared to, we hype the drug and then we make that comparison to see how much of the drug effect is drug versus how much is really placebo. You know, what happens if you have a copay and you end up paying less for the drug? Does the drug become less effective? Some very interesting work that he has done of that nature. I don't know where Professor Ariely is. Our team is attempting to connect with him again.
I believe he is there on the line.
I beg your pardon?
I believe he is there on the line. Professor Ariely, are you there?
How are you?
Oh, you're there. Oh, welcome to the show. I've been so looking forward to talking to you today. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. You've been doing such a good summary of my results. I'm not sure I'm needed.
No, yeah, I didn't know you were on the line. We lost you for a minute, and so I was just giving a little more background on who you are. It's an honor to have you join us today. I've followed your work. I don't know how much of the setup piece you missed before we disconnected. I have all three of your books. You happen to be one of my favorite authors. Now, and I know everybody tells you that. So I'm going to start you out with an off-the-wall question.
Especially talking about cheating, it's a funny way to start.
All right. Listen, as I said, I'm going to start you off with an off-the-wall question. You've been prepared for this. So I've been collecting the answers from our recent guests, regarding, and I suppose I should say, and looking for a pattern to emerge. But my new question arises from a conversation that Dee Wallace and I had. She suggested that we all need a song of life. and hopefully not some country western "You Did Me Wrong" song. So what is your song of life, Professor?
So song of life. So I have to basically say that I have two little kids, and my song of life right now is the Bare Necessities from the Jungle Book.
Oh, that's a wonderful one. That's a wonderful one.
That's adorable.
One of the things that I happened to mention in the while we were killing time, since we went right to your family, is you've made some interesting comments on the irrationality of marriage. You know, and there's two parts to that. Of course, there's marriage and there's having children. Is it rational in this day and age to get married and to have children?
So I actually had this discussion with some friends the day before yesterday, and here is something I remembered, and I'll just kind of share this with you, and then you can tell me what you think. So I was, as you know, I was in hospital for a very, very long time.
Yes.
And there was a guy in the room next to me that when he worked on disassembling a landmine, the landmine got exploded, and he lost one leg, one eye, and one arm. And at the time, he had a girlfriend. And 6 weeks after his injury, she left him. And we were all appalled, and he actually defended her. But then I started thinking, you know, what if they were married, right? I mean, what would be the contract that people have? Now, we tend to think about getting married or just dating if you don't have kids and forget the tax ramification. We tend to think that those things don't matter. But I think they would. I think that the moment you get into marriage, something in the social contract, and it's not the legal thing, and it's not the money thing, something about the contract really changes. So weddings have lots of things, right? We stand there in front of lots of people, we spend lots of money on ceremonies, but I think in addition to the kind of the cognitive dissonance and the promise we make to other people, I think in addition to that, there is something extra on that does mean that we will stick with the other person when other things happen, that just dating doesn't do it. And even if you handshake and you said, okay, this is it, we're going to stay together, I don't think people would feel as the same strong commitment that they have to when things go very badly.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think there's something important about marriage. Now, it is irrational in the sense that, you know, in a rational world, you should always evaluate what's your options and is this good for you or bad for you and should you stay and should you go. But I think there's something incredibly important about promises we make to ourselves and promises we make to other people. And even if it doesn't make sense from the perspective of maximizing our selfish best interest, we still keep them. By the way, we find the same thing with handshakes, right? When you imagine you went to buy a car and you agreed with somebody about the car, and then you found something else that was better for you. But how would you feel if you shook the person's hand and you said, okay, I'm back here in 5 to buy the car? You would probably feel an extra sense of obligation.
Right.
I think it's an irrational but incredibly interesting extra sense of obligation.
Indeed. I swearing on a Bible in a court of law, even for an atheist, you have pointed out, makes a marked difference in the testimony or the honesty that they give in the court.
Yep. So you know this well, but just for the listeners, we are doing lots of experiments on dishonesty when we tempt people to steal money from us. And we do it in a very simple way. We give people a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems, and we say, solve as many of those as you can in the next 5 minutes. We'll give you $1 per question. And people work as fast as they can. At the end of the 5 minutes, we say, stop, please put your pencil down and count how many questions you got correctly. Now go to the back of the room and shred that piece of paper. And once you've shredded, come to the front of the room, tell us how many questions you got correctly, we'll pay you accordingly. People do this, they say they solve 6 problems, we say we pay them $6 and they go home. But what the people in the experiment don't know is that we played with the shredder. So the shredder only shred the size of the box, but the main body only shred the size of the page, but the main body of the page remains intact, mm-hmm. and we can find out how many questions people really solve correctly. And what do we find? We find that lots of people cheat a little bit. On average, people solve four problems and report to be solving six. And it's not driven by big cheaters. It's driven by a ton of little cheaters. More than half of the people are cheating just a little bit. Now, so this is kind of the beginning of what we have. Now, what you talked about is this question of what do we do about it? And it turns out that if we ask people just before they do this test to try and recall the Ten Commandments or to swear on the Bible or to do all kinds of things, all of a sudden they stop cheating. And this is kind of a good part of human behavior, right? It's irrational, but it's a good part of human behavior that the moment we remind people about their own moral shackles and their own kind of moral obligation and how they want to be, all of a sudden people behave much, much nicer.
But there's also the social context to that that you discuss. Flesh that out a little bit, the in-group, the out-group, the social contagion.
Yeah, so that's very important. I'll tell you a story first. I talked recently to a person who's been doping in sports. This was a cyclist that was taking drugs, not Lance Armstrong, but somebody else in cycling. And he basically said that at some point it became clear to him that everybody else was doping. And, you know, it wasn't as if he didn't know it was illegal, but all of a sudden the legality didn't matter because we know there's some things that are legal and not legal. What determines moral and immoral is what the people around us are doing. So if everybody around us downloads illegal material from the internet and don't feel bad about it, we don't feel bad about it too. So to look at this, we did the same experiment I described to you earlier, but what we did was we hired an acting student, and we asked that acting students to stand up and cheat in an egregious way. And now the question is, what would happen when you see somebody cheat in an egregious way? And what happened is many more people cheat. But you could say, well, there could be two interpretations here. One is that that person just demonstrated the cheating was possible, that there's no cost to cheating. You know, they stood up, they took all the money, they went home, nobody chased them. The second interpretation is it's not about the cost-benefit analysis. It's about what is acceptable and not acceptable by people like you. So to look at this, we compared two ways of dressing that student up. And the key here is we ran this experiment at a university called Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And everybody was a Carnegie Mellon student, and the acting student was a Carnegie Mellon student. But in the second condition, he was wearing a University of Pittsburgh sweatshirt. So he was associated with that group. Now think to yourself, what happens when they belong to this other group? From a cost-benefit analysis, it's just the same thing. They prove that in this experiment you can cheat and get away with it, but they don't give the social proof. They don't say, hey, it's people like you who are dishonest in this experiment. And what happens now? Now cheating actually goes down. So people say, oh, cheating is involved, and it's these other people we don't like so much. Let me be extra careful. And indeed, people were extra careful. So what it suggests is that the issue about dishonesty is really about what are the people around us doing. And once we understand what people around us are doing, that's really set up the rules for what we find acceptable and not acceptable.
Your work is just totally fascinating to me. We've got a break coming up, and during the break, we're going to show in our chat room one of your studies, as you're reporting it on YouTube, having to do with the honesty of bankers and politicians. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you to flesh that story out for all of our listeners who don't happen to be in our chat room. The book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. If you're not already in our chat room, this is an excellent time to join in the conversation. We have a short video for you of our guest, as I mentioned. Just go to eldentaylor.com/chat. Now, if you have an opportunity, I'm going to encourage you to be sure and check out on Google Arming the Donkeys, which is Professor Ariely's blog site. And it's an incredible blog site. It's audio interviews, and they're just absolutely fascinating. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after these words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're discussing the new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves, with author Professor Dan Ariely. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies, and from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my site and get your free MP3. Now, one more thing, and again, I want to repeat this. You do not want to miss Professor Ariely's blog, so check out Arming the Donkeys on Google. All right, let's get back to the show. Now, during the break, those of you that are in the chat room watched a clip that, for all intent and purposes, was answering the question, who's the most honest, bankers or politicians? Now, even if you have the answer, I want the professor to flesh this story out. So let's pick it up there, Professor Ariely. Sure. Tell us about this study.
So let me make first of all, a general comment. The general comment is that we tend to see lots of cultural differences. We think that young people and old people are different, and men and women, Generation X, Generation Y, people in different countries. So we decided to run these experiments that I described, in which we tempt people to steal money from us in different places, and see, is there cultural variations? So as you could probably tell from my accent, I grew up in Israel, so I tried Israel in the beginning. This was my first attempt. Turns out the Israelis are just like the Americans. I tried China. My Italian collaborator, Francesca Gino, said, come to Italy, we'll show you what the Italians can do. But it turns out the Italians are just like the Americans. So everything we tried was very, very similar. So what's happening here? How could that be? And what we did come up with a conclusion is that it's not that culture doesn't matter, but our experiments really measure this very basic ability to fudge, this basic ability to rationalize a little bit. And we can all cheat a little bit and still think of ourselves as good people. Now, if we cheat a lot, we can't, but if we cheat just a little bit, we feel okay. And this amount is basically constant across the world. Now, this is because our experiments are abstract and general. It's the first time people see them. They're not embedded in any cultural context. But of course, there are huge cultural contexts. You know, if somebody grew up in a certain society and that society said, cheating is okay in this domain, for example, don't worry about illegal downloads, or don't worry about paying your taxes, right, or don't worry about cheating the insurance company. But so I said that we don't find many cultural differences. We did find one, which was between bankers and politicians. And the story is that we went and we ran this experiment in a bar where congressional staffers hang out in Washington, D.C. And we ran another version of this in a place where bankers hang out, in just outside of Wall Street. And this was the only place we saw a difference. And the difference was that the bankers cheated twice as much as the politicians. However, there are two things we should be cautious about. The first one is that this was money which is closer in domain to what the bankers deal with than the politicians. So that might be one thing to think about. The second thing is that these were just junior politicians. So maybe there's more room for growth over time. And you know, if you think about the social contingent, it's actually quite possible that there's going to be much more cheating over time.
Right. Well, now I don't want to pick up bankers because my banker is a friend of mine. But while we're on bankers, you were asked to speak at a meeting of many bankers, and during that you explained to them how disproportionate bonuses, extra large bonuses, could actually impede production. I don't want to explain it. Please tell us that story.
So, you know, when we think about bonuses, there's lots of ideas about what could happen with bonuses. Where could they come from? What's their effectiveness? But mostly the belief is that higher bonuses are going to get people to work to a larger degree. And we really should ask ourselves, where is this idea coming from? So we said, look, when you give people higher bonuses, they want to try better. There's no question they want to. But can they succeed? right? So if I paid you $1 million to do something, let's say to tell me a really funny joke, could you tell me a funny joke, or could you just be thinking, oh my goodness, it's not working, where's the funny thing? So we did this study in which we gave people six tasks that require cognitive thinking and concentration and memory and all kinds of things like that. And some people, we said, look, if you do well these tasks, we'll give you a bonus equal to 1 day of salary. In 1 hour, you could get 1 day of salary. If you do half, you'll get half. If you do a third, you do third, you get third, and so on. Other people, we said, if you do well on this task, you'll get 2 weeks' salaries, right? A bigger bonus.
Right.
And yet other people, we said, if you do well on this task, you'll get 5 months of salary. So people could make in 1 hour what they make in regularly in 5 months. And what happened? What happened to performance? Well, as you know, performance actually went down. Performance did not change between the 1 week, 1 day bonus and the 2 week bonus, but it went down dramatically for the 5 months bonus condition. And actually, looking at the behavior of the people in the study gave very clear indication for where this came from. It was basically stress, right? There was so much money involved. There was so much possibility. They were just overly stressed. And when they were so overly stressed, they couldn't focus on anything, right? Now, in some sense, this is, you know, the moment you explain this, you could say, oh, this is not very surprising. But of course, then you have to figure out why is it we are so happy with giving people bonuses all the time, right? Where is this idea that bonuses are going to get people to perform better? So for me, what's amazing is that the moment you start thinking about it, you realize that there's a good chance that bonuses are actually not doing something that's useful for us.
And right. In fact, the maze bright, overstimulated rat story.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a story, the story you're referring to with the rats. It's a story showing that when you give rats electrical shocks, as the amount of the size of the electrical shock increases, they want to succeed faster. They want to learn where the maze is and what's working on and not, and in order to get out of there. But the problem is that as the amount of shock gets higher, at some level, it's just too much. They get overstressed and they perform much, much worse.
Right.
By the way, the bankers don't like this.
Back
story,
to the
right?
Bankers.
Yes. So the bankers, the moment you talk to them about rats and you talk to them about regular people and so on, they're very happy to think that regular people are going to behave like this. The moment you say, well, this might also apply to banking and to really big bonuses, the bailiff says, no, this can't happen. And then they start coming up with all kinds of stories about why this doesn't apply to them. So, you know, one thing they say is that they're super special people. They don't have the same mistakes that other people. You know, they tell all kinds of stories. And some of those stories are hard for us to kind of measure, right? I'm an empirical guy. I like experiments. And if you have an idea, let's test it. But this is difficult. But we did look at basketball players. And basketball players have what they call clutch players. These are people who are supposedly very good at the moment when the kind of the chips are down. And everybody, we talk to NBA coaches, and they all agree about who are the clutch players, who are the 17 people in the league who are the known clutch players. But then we looked at their performance. So we actually went back to basketball games and we coded them. And we looked at how many points they got in the last 5 minutes of the game versus the last 5 minutes of the first half. And what we found was that they got more points, but they did not improve their percentage shooting. So what happened, everybody thinks they're clutch players, everybody passes the ball to them more frequently, they try more frequently, they don't succeed more frequently, but because they try more frequently, they basically do get more points. And I think because of this, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Other people are saying, oh, this happened last time, and then they keep on doing it over and over and over. So it's kind of interesting that even in the domain of basketball, where, you know, basketball is really competitive, it's hard to be that good, and everybody agrees about who the clutch player is. Even in that domain of life, we don't really find people who are really good under stress. Now, in that case, we don't find them performing worse. But there is some evidence, this is not from my study, somebody else's study, showing that when people played against Tiger Woods, when he was the top one ranked player, they right. played actually slightly worse when they played against him. And I think it's the same thing. Is this extra stress of playing against somebody really good gets people to be stressed, even if they are professional players, and perform worse.
I relate to that. You know, bringing you on this radio show made me more nervous than I've been, and I can't tell you how long, sir. Now, let's go back to the bankers for a minute. You're in the meeting, and you pointed this out to them, and they tell you that they're super special people, and then you get one of them to kind of volunteer, and you ask them what they do in November and December. Pick it up there, because I found that really interesting.
Yeah, so you know, I said, of course you can always come to the lab, and you know, if you really believe that, come and do some studies. But you know, they're not that interested really. So I said, okay, so let's forget stress. Let's just think about how does your month look like in November and December? What do you do? How is your day structured? And they basically admitted that they spend most of the day just looking and recalculating their bonuses, right? So they're saying that they're not concerned by the stress doesn't do it, but when they describe what they actually do, they basically said they open an Excel spreadsheet and they try to kind of recalculate every morning how much they will make in bonus this year. And, you know, in many ways, it's incredibly understandable, right? If you are going to get 90% of your salary as a bonus, wouldn't you be incredibly interested in how much it would be?
Yep.
And if that was the office discussion as well, wouldn't you just keep on calculating it all the time and figure out where you stand? So what happened is that I think actually it's incredibly crazy for us to assume that they will not spend most of their cognitive capacity and time and attention on this. Here is the strange thing, right? We say we want people to work. We want them to do a certain thing. But we don't think they will do it naturally. So we'll take a ton of money and we'll put it on their path. And by them thinking about the money all the time, they would somehow do the job better. It's just a very strange setup when you think about it like this. Right? In what universe would you want your physician, for example, to focus on a bonus when they're thinking about operating on your brain? Right? It's just incredibly strange.
Yes, it is. Before we leave the cultural, how about poor people versus rich people? Is one group more or less inclined to cheat than the other?
So that's a very good question, and the answer is yes and no. So we've actually done studies in across lots of things. I live in Durham, North Carolina, and we've been waiting for people outside of the parole office. So these are people who come out of prison and parole, and we test them there and then. We also test people in community centers, which are relatively poor. We've tested bankers and politicians in bars. So we've tested people across a range of economic status, and we don't find any differences. However, the moment we take somebody and we make them believe that their particular lot in life is unjust, you know, I say, you know what, you should have done better. Things should have played for you, but you know, sadly, you know, you're more talented and so on than what you got in life. You know, things just did not play for you correctly. Now you feel more justified cheating more. So it's not so much about the actual level of wealth, is the level of believed wealth compared to where you're standing. So to me, this suggests that it's all, again, about rationalization. That the moment you can rationalize something, you can behave in certain ways. And poor people are not better able to rationalize than rich people. But the moment people feel that they are poor for a reason that is not their own, now it's easier for them to rationalize it.
We see some of that, I think, going on in the political process in our country right now.
Well, you know, in the political case, it's so easy, right? In the political case, what's going on is that people can so easily say, you know, if you only vote for me, the whole country will be better off. So what's telling another lie? Plus, the other person is telling lies, too, and so on. So it's really easy to do it. The moment you can convince yourself that you're just like Robin Hood, it becomes incredibly easy.
Okay, now I've got. I mean, we opened that bailiwick. I've got to have to follow it just a little bit. You commented on the presidential candidates in our last election, and one of your remarks seems somewhat counterintuitive to many, and that was you stated that we don't know much about Obama, but typically when a person does not know much about another person, they fill in the blank favorably. Now, before I ask you to flesh that out, there is current research that suggests a difference in the physical nature of the brain and how we process information between conservative and liberal extremes. And one of those differences seems to suggest that the conservative might be put off by those blanks more than the person inclined to be more liberal. So, two-part question. Please flesh out what you meant by we see it more favorably. And then, would you see that perhaps the division or the polarization, the actual election itself, followed some kind of organization, brain organization, that was different because of that blank?
Yeah. So I think these are kind of two separate topics, and I think the connections you're drawing are interesting. So first of all, let's talk about the separate issues. So one of the things we know from all the way from romantic attraction is that when we don't know much about people, we tend to fill the blanks in over-positive ways. So you think about the first Obama presidential elections, we didn't know much about him. There was lots of promise. We filled it in over-optimistic way. And, you know, as a consequence, we were over-optimistic about him. Similarly to Romney, in this election, we knew less about him than we knew about Obama. And as we learned more and more about Romney as a nation, I think people became less and less enchanted with him. We find this with online dating. We find it with regular dating. We find it with hiring. People often hire from the outside rather than from the inside, because when they hire from the outside, they don't know much about the person. Their imagination can run loose. In terms of the finding about brain science and Republicans and Democrats, you know, this is kind of early days for this research.
Right.
But one of the generalizations that has been made from that is that Republicans are more rigid in their thinking. For example, there was a study that showed that you train people for a long time that if they see the letter, the letter R on the screen, they should press the zero button, and they see the letter L, they should press the one button, and they do it for a long time. And after they learn it for a long time, you switch. And you say, now click the opposite key to what you did before. And they show that Republicans take slightly longer to adapt to this particular pattern. And they also show that Republicans, you know, these are vast generalizations, but they show that Republicans seem to like things that are more clear-cut, and ambiguity is more aversive to them, right?
So right, when something which is very to the clear, point that of my question, right?
That's right. Now, from that perspective, I think, and this is where I think your question is interesting. So now you're saying, okay, so Republicans want things that are more clear-cut and less open for interpretation. Now the question is, what happens when you don't know much about somebody? Do you acknowledge that you don't know, and therefore it's aversive and more to Republicans than Democrats because of the ambiguity? Or do you fill the information from your mind in a way that you think you actually know something? Right? So I don't know which one of those is correct. It could be that the moment people fill in the information from their brains, all of a sudden they say, I'm perfectly fine with that. Now, it's not true what they think they know, but nevertheless it's influencing them. So right. I don't know which one of those is the right case.
That'd be an interesting study. I have to ask you something a little on the light side now, coming off of that. I'm holding your book. I'm looking at your book. And on the cover of the book, you know, we have a portrait of a modern Pinocchio gazing into a mirror and seeing a honest self looking back. So, I mean, we have, here's the same figure, extended nose, but what's looking back from the mirror doesn't have that extended nose. Now, I get the symbology, but I have to ask you, a new dissertation that was just finished. It's not published yet in a referee journal, but it's all over everywhere, that suggests our nose grows warmer when we lie. Are you familiar with that? And if so, what do you think of that?
This is a part of the embodied cognition stuff.
Yes, it's in process now. The study itself, it's called the Pinocchio Effect. It's a doctoral thesis. It's not yet published, but I have a copy of it here in front of me. In fact, I can get it to you. It was conducted at the University of Granada in Spain. They used thermography. Yeah. Because of my background in lie detection, I still pay close attention to these kinds of things. And I just found that very funny.
It is incredibly interesting, right? And I think the question is it just specific to the nose, or is there kind of a general blood situation? Because I would think about the nose as having lots of fluctuation in blood supply. So it is kind of surprising. You know, I would think about the ears maybe as having more, maybe the lips. But the nose, it is an interesting thing. And, you know, maybe this is the reason for Pinocchio. I mean, you wonder, like, how come the intuition is that the nose is reflecting dishonesty, right? I mean, you could imagine it would have been the ears or the eyes or something else.
Exactly.
So maybe there is something about this intuition that actually fits with something real that is happening, but only now we can document it.
You know, if there was ever a time I wanted this show to be 2 hours, it is right now, but we've just got a couple of minutes. You do this work to help people see themselves more clearly and perhaps become more rational and reflective, you know, make the right choices, be less destructive, self-destructive, and so on. What would you tell our listening audience they should do if that's what they would want to realize in their life?
Yeah, so this, I have to say, is a heavy burden. So basically, what we're finding is that lots of good people could be slightly dishonest and still think of themselves as good people. And when somebody have a biased incentive, like a conflict of interest, this is the recipe for that. Now, think about something like your financial advisor. Think about something like your dentist, your mechanic, your lawyer, accountant, whoever you're hiring. Those people have conflicts of interest. And I think it's incredibly important for us to realize that. Now, I'm not saying that when you go to your dentist that they are evil people and they want to do things for you that are unneeded or unnecessary. But I am saying that they're going to be influenced by their financial incentives beyond what they think they are and beyond what you think they are. So if a dentist can drill a hole somewhere that doesn't really call for it and they can make a little extra money, it's not that they're bad people and they're saying, I don't care about the patient. They're going to be biased to view the world as if everything right. is a whole, because that gives them more money. Now, right. This is a very difficult way to go around the world, because I'll tell you, I do it all the time. I talk to my dentist and I worry, what is their incentives? And I insist a little bit more that they will show me the evidence. And is this really the good thing to do? And really the right thing to do? And when I go to my doctor, I do the same thing, and my financial advisor. So I think in general, it's basically saying that we think that people are either good or bad. The reality is that we're all capable of bad things. And because of that, we should be really careful when other people have bad incentives.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Professor Arielli. I do want you to give everybody your website so they can follow up, contact you. Please do that. We have about 10 seconds.
My website is just my name, Dan Arielli, danarielly.com. I have a blog. I have videos. I also have this Arming the Donkey podcast. It's fun.
Yeah, don't miss it. Don't miss it. We're going to have to bring you back. We've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment. I want to thank the wonderful team at Hay House for making what we do on this show so easy. And, of course, a big thank you to our guests and to all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. Until then, remember, believing in yourself always matters.